Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome to another episode of the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 74, being recorded on the 22nd of April, 2015. I'm Sujit Mello, and on Skype with me I have Evan Basilik and Kale Teeter. And the topic we're going to talk about today is the Azure Data Factory. Kale's been doing some work with it with a customer, and he figured he'd educate both Evan and myself and our listeners on this service, which hasn't gotten a whole lot of coverage, but sounds like it might be useful to a lot of people in a lot of scenarios. So we'll kind of get some information on that from Kale in just a couple of minutes. But before we start there, there's been a few news updates this week, not so much in terms of new services, but some of the services and some of the new enhancements in Azure that were previously in preview form are now going GA. For example, the DocumentDB service. I think we had, what's the name of the gentleman from the product team that we had on who talked about DocumentDB? Ryan, right?
Ryan Crocker,
Yeah, that was a really nice episode. I remember that. So that service is finally going GA. It was generally available April 8th, so it's a couple of weeks ago. And just a little reminder, that's our, you know, fully managed NoSQL document database service, which allows you to, you know, just kind of throw JSON documents into it, and they're fully indexed across any field. They have a variety of performance levels that you can, you know, you can pay for depending on how what kind of query performance you want from those documents, and you even buy your units of of the load that you're going to be putting onto this DocumentDB database. So that's all GA now, and so if you've been looking for going into production with something, now you can.
Yeah, I need to, you know, when I saw that it released, I need to maybe go do some digging, because one of the things that we struggle with on my team, I don't know about you guys in your spaces, but like there's just content coming out like crazy, right? You know, internal content, external content, mm-hmm. and we write all this stuff up, right? And we kind of write our training and everything, but then trying to figure out like, how do you find this stuff? I was wondering, and I'm gonna try and go play with it at some point, but if I put a bunch of my documents in DocDB, maybe that's a better way to search this stuff and find it.
Yeah.
It sounds like it would be.
I mean, they use the word documents kind of loosely over here. The documents actually JSON formatted messages, you know, that have various fields. Of course, you know, you could put, they could be large and small fields in there.
Right. That's the thing. But if I just stick this stuff in, right, yeah, into some sort of JSON structure, even if it's just a big blob of text.
Correct.
Right. Does it become easier to search this stuff and you know, does GraphDB like maybe find some of these relationships? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. Some of the enhancements that they have put into the service just as it went GA was integrated with Hadoop. So now, you know, this could be another data source that Hadoop MapReduce job can query. And
right.
They've done things like SQL parameterization of the queries, and they have a Java SDK out, and they've made it available in a number of regions as well. So a lot of new enhancements, you know, between the time we spoke to Ryan about it and now. So all good stuff. Looking forward to that service, and sure it's going to hit your support desk and sooner or later.
Yeah, that actually ends up going to a peer team of mine, but yeah. I know they were ramping up to get ready on it, so I may wander up there and talk to them as well.
And then the other one that also went GA this past week was Stream Analytics. And just a little recap on that. This is the real-time stream processing engine in the cloud that, you know, like if you're doing a lot of this IoT stuff, and you're capturing a lot of information from sensors and various applications. You could be applying some sort of logic as that data is coming in, even if it's a volume of data, and trying to determine certain patterns in there. And I think when we spoke about it one time, I think the question we asked was, I wonder if this could be used to determine patterns in, say, the market, right?
Yep.
Can you imagine if you're getting that stream of ticker information and you're trying to figure out stuff? I guess that'd be interesting if someone's going to use it for that.
Yeah, I remember I worked with this was a long time ago when I was in SQL support. There was a company that, I don't remember what they did, but they were in that world or that business, and they were actually pulling data back and storing it in memory and then, you know, running queries and running analytics against it. And they were trying to keep as much as they could in memory at all times,
right,
so that it would be super fast, because, like, they couldn't take the extra even couple milliseconds of dumping it to a database.
Wow.
And that this was back, you know, golly, this must have been 6-8 years ago. You know, and now that stuff has gotten even faster. I gotta think something like Stream Analytics is really the companies that do this today probably have something similar, but it's probably something maybe that's either custom code or highly optimized. You gotta wonder if they're able to start using something like Stream Analytics and then customize on top of that so that they don't have to worry about a lot of the stuff they don't have to worry about managing.
Yeah.
You know. So kind of really truly turn it into a service. So.
Service, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, well, that would kind of be, I mean, a lot of folks up your way, Sujeet, that's kind of what their business is.
Yeah, up in Wall Street, I'm sure that they'll be looking at that. And because it's, you know, you pay for what you use, you can imagine, right? You could just have to run it from 9:30 to 4 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly.
You shut it down. No, that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that would be, you know, highly optimized at that point, right?
Yep.
You know, yep. Start it up, you know, 20 minutes before the market opens and, you know, shut it down at the end. And yeah.
That's it. And then the third thing that went into GA was the Azure Premium Storage, right? This is our SSD based storage that we offer, and you can get them up to 50,000 IOPS, which is kind of ridiculous, but it is available, and up to 32 gigabytes of, you know, storage. This is all SSD-based storage, so pretty cool stuff, and it's pretty much available in most of the regions right now. There's a 99.9% availability that's, you know, SLA that's been applied to it. So that's all the new technologies that are out there. You know, before we let Kale loose on the data factory topic. You know, there's one thing that's been bothering me. The other news that came out this past week. What is it? We call it the Fabric service or the app, this microservice framework that we've come up with, right? Kale, do you remember what you remember about that?
I've been hearing a lot about that. We had some internal stuff on that, but I wasn't a part of it.
So. I must have missed this. What was this called?
So it's
called the Service Fabric.
Yeah, Azure Service Fabric. So it's a PaaS offering, right? That's meant to handle this microservice movement that's been building steam right now. Microservices are kind of very small, single-purpose services that are built, and then you kind of compose each of these services into more meaningful services. But, you know, each of these services themselves is very single-purpose, so they call them microservices. And this new Azure Service Fabric, which they announced this past week, is supposed to address that within Azure. And I believe they're also going to make that available into Windows on-premises in the future. So, you know, what's been bothering me is that we've got this Service Fabric, then we've got the Docker containers, which is another container technology, which kind of does the same thing. And then we've got all these new app services, mobile apps, logic apps, API apps. It just feels like there's just too many ways to slice and dice the...
Yeah, but it's always been that way, right? I mean, there's the folks that are, hey, new shiny, and then go after the new thing, and then there's the folks that, hey, I'm doing the way that I've done it for 20 years, and I'm going to change it as minimally as possible, and then most of us, you know, that probably sit in the middle. I think this is all about just there's people out there wanting to try all these different implementations and different ways of doing it for, you know, and different businesses have different needs.
Right.
You know, in the service world, right, you provide it for everybody. You know?
Yeah, I just hope we come up with some better guidance around what to use where, because right now it's kind of confusing.
And, oh, I see what you're saying from the side of somebody trying to decide what to do, not somebody who's already decided.
Yeah, because there's so many ways to approach it now. It's like you're going to pull your hair out trying to figure out the right way. I mean, as I said, you're right that, you know, if you're used to a particular way of doing it, you're probably going to gravitate towards that way. But with all these new ways, especially the microservices and these new app services that have come out in Azure, you know, it's not really clear how you take advantage of all these things. So we're hoping to get some of the product team guys on. But as you guys mentioned, there's a build coming up, right, in a couple of weeks. Well, is it next week or is it a week after? I think it's the end of the month, right?
Yeah, the one's like the week of the 29th and then
ignites
the
after that.
Week or vice versa.
No, I think it's the right after that.
Yeah.
So a lot of the product team is kind of ramping up that, getting ready. So we're going to have to wait until after Ignite sometime in the middle of May before we get some of those guys on the show to help us out here.
Yeah, I agree with you, Sujeet. There's like so many options now. I mean, that's what we spend the majority of the time doing is educating customers and trying to figure out what's the best place to place what they need, their workload.
Right.
You know, it'd be nice if there was just like a button where you could just say or answer like 5 questions and say, here's my workload. What's the best way to run it? PaaS, IaaS, all this stuff, whatever, Fabric, you know. But the reality is I agree with you, by the way, but the other thing I think about is like it's always been that way. And maybe Evan was saying that. It was like, you know, we had app domains and all these things that were in memory, not the container stuff, but, you know, we had ways to kind of do some of this stuff for years, you know, and there was always a million different ways to run your web servers and how you set up your load balancers and all that stuff. But yeah, I just think, you know, I wish there was a lower bar there, yeah, as well.
I'm sure we'll go get to the bottom of that.
I gotta think some of this is, you know, 'cause I mean, I've been doing this for a long time now, and even I struggle with some of the new stuff about what, you know, when should I switch to that from the old stuff. And I think some of it is, it literally is people can't keep up with, like the guidance can't keep up clearly, but I don't even know that the general public can really keep up with, you know, what to go use. I mean.
For how fast the stuff's coming out, yeah.
Yeah, I do think it's going to probably become a bigger and bigger challenge. What I have to wonder is, I mean, do you think in a couple of years things are going to slow down? Or do you think this is all the, kind of everybody storming in, doing new stuff and trying to figure it out, and it'll start to slow down? Or do you guys think it's just going to continue to accelerate?
Well, there's always going to be companies that have existing code that want to bring it over. So they'll probably want, you know, the traditional ways of doing programming. But then there's all these new ways, which are more apparently more efficient, easier to manage, et cetera, and scale up. So it really depends. I guess we're always going to have this wide variety. I was just hoping that we'd be able to provide proper guidance to our customers on which path to go on, you know, as opposed to, you know, it's very easy to go down the wrong path right now. You know, you might just say, as you said, it's a shiny toy. Let's just go with that. And then once you're in production, you realize that you know, this was not the right approach for you. And that's what we want to avoid.
Yeah, I wonder if I mean, what is it? The old patterns and practices team used to do a lot of this work. I'm not even sure if they exist or some equivalent.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up because they just released the Azure patterns and practices document this past week. I'll put it in the show notes.
I swear that was not setting you up.
Yes, I will. I will say that is correct. We never discussed that before the show, so this was, and the only reason because I've been reading that for my customer, there's some excellent guidance. They really have done a good job on that, especially on the API and services side. And of course, they don't really talk about which specific service to use. Their guidance is more on how you create your application in Azure or make it cloud friendly. But they really have been coming out with some really cool stuff, and I'll put them in the show notes, we'll put the, all that information out there.
Yeah, that'd be great.
One other thing, too, Sajid, I wanted to mention that's not a negative thing, but it's something that's happening, is the App Fabric stuff. Mm. So that's being end-of-life support next year, right around this time. So 4.2, I think it is,
right.
2016, will be end-of-life for the the on-premises version of the App Fabric stuff that we had.
Right, and that's the with the caching.
Yeah.
And what else was there? The... We had that other web server management piece. I don't think anybody actually used it there. But yeah, so are we saying people should use Redis now? Is that the message?
I mean, that's been the guidance for a while. Like any new applications, the guidance from the team was to use Redis, and they would continue to support in a maintenance mode kind of thing the App Fabric. And now there's been an announcement that. Yeah, like I said, like a year from now, it's going to be end of life.
Wow. Yeah, it was a little surprised to hear that, but sure, there's been some.
I was going to say, it was going to come at some point, right? We kind of threw our all our efforts behind Redis.
Yeah.
Although I got to be honest, it's kind of when we talk about it, right? Redis was probably, I mean, if I think back to all the things that we did, that was probably one of the first things where we kind of came out and said, you know what? We're new. This is the new Microsoft. We're not going to redevelop it just because we can, right? It was really early in that trend.
Exactly. Yeah, we had Pranav Rastogi on the show, right? He's the Redis guy.
Yeah.
And he kind of gave us the back story there. I mean, I think it's all a reflection on the new Microsoft. It's all good stuff. Yeah.
No, exactly. Exactly.
And Evan, you have a boot camp coming up. You want to tell our listeners about that in case anyone happens to be in the Charlotte area?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are in the Charlotte area this weekend, the 25th, here on the Microsoft campus in Charlotte, we are doing participating in the Global Azure Boot Camp. So actually, I wasn't thinking about this earlier, Sajid, but this is actually going on all across the country, actually all across the world. If you do a search, we'll put the link in the show notes, but there's a kind of a central link for the Global Azure Boot Camp. And, there's 150 some odd sites or something like that. It might even be more than that. But everybody kind of has they don't all have the same exact agenda, but it's kind of the same goal, right? Expose people to Azure, come get your hands on playing with it and the like. And, but we're doing one here in Charlotte. We've got some local community folks are speaking. I'm speaking. Some of the other folks from the Microsoft are speaking. But really, just come out and have a good time. We got some food. We're going to talk a lot about our Azure, and it's going to be a bunch of geeky folks sitting around talking geeky stuff all day.
Nice. Very nice.
So from 8:30 to 5 local. I think the different regional ones, I've seen some that started a little earlier and some a little bit later, but definitely we'll put the link in the show notes, and I encourage everybody to find their local one. And if you are here in the Charlotte area, come see me, come up and say hey, and tell me you listen to the podcast. And once my mouth drops in shock that somebody actually listens to us, then it'd be great to meet a listener in person. So
that would be great. Yep. All right, and we haven't mentioned this in a while, but our listeners, if you've got any ideas for topics that you'd like for us to cover on the podcast, we did get a few recently, and we're going to look into them. But wanted to take this chance to ask our listeners to provide us with feedback on the topics that we're talking about here, and suggest any new topics or other topics that we should be covering on the show that are of interest to you. And we'll certainly either try to cover them ourselves or, of course, reach out within Microsoft or within our contacts and have somebody on the show to help us out there. So without much ado, let's get on with the Data Factory. Yeah. Kale, can you give us a little bit of background on this?
Sure. So this is something that came out a while back, and I hadn't had a chance to get exposed to it because we were doing other things with Azure and, with my normal day job. And, I got a chance to start looking at it. And actually one of my customers was looking at using it for some things and was asking some questions about it. And, so had a chance to kind of deep dive into it a little bit more to see what this thing's all about. And, when I first heard about it, and actually when you go up and look at it in the portal, it's in the new portal. under the data analytics section. So if you're provisioning something, you'll see it there. And so when you look at, you think about big data or something like that, this is some sort of thing to support big data, which I think was a primary driver for it. But I see this thing being useful for other things. Once I started to get my hands on it, I was like, wait, I can see where I could use this for other options too. So anybody that's come from a data background or a database background using tools for like ETL, like SSIS or some of those tools, think of this kind of a little bit in that realm. So really the goal was it basically is able to consume data sources. So we talk about what those are, but they can be a variety of different things. It could be databases in relational format. It could be unstructured data. It could be files on a file system. And basically you define definitions for these kind of things to say, here's what my data looks like. And then you define what they call data tables, which is basically a schema. So you're starting to schematize whatever that thing was, whether it already had a schema or maybe it didn't. And so you build these data tables. And then the cool thing is you can start to link these data tables together in what's called a pipeline. So you could say, I have data in the file system and a relational database that are important to my business for some reason. And so I define these inputs and I define these tables and I set up a pipeline to bring them into maybe a relational database in Azure. And then maybe I have a BI platform or something on the other side of that that's reading from this, I'll call it a meta directory, but this central database that brings all my other data together. And so it's a really cool thing because it's basically based on JSON. So you define all this stuff that I'm talking about in JSON format, and you can do it all in your web browser. So you just go up to the portal, provision this. We have, I think, 5 different data sources we support now. So it's like a traditional – and it actually supports on-premises. We can talk about how that works, an on-premises SQL database as a source, as well as an Azure SQL database. And then it supports, like I said, file systems. So if you had a file share with some stuff on, as well as blob storage. So okay. What's neat is you can actually transform too. So it's kind of like SSIS in that respect, that once you start linking these things together in your pipeline, the pipeline is what builds a relationship between these, you can actually inject code in there then too. So you could do transforms and say, like, when you bring in this data from this unstructured thing, you have to massage it a little bit before you put it in here. Very similar to what we do with SSIS.
Okay, Kayla,
how does that differentiate with this talk? Oh, I'm sorry, Sajid.
No, go ahead. Yeah, it's a good question.
How does this fit in with the BizTalk kind of scenario? Because that sounds a lot like BizTalk.
Yeah, it's less about web services and more just about raw data services and this really lightweight like framework that they have.
Okay.
So it's very, very, very quick to spin up. BizTalk definitely has its place for like orchestration and those kind of things, but it's a lot more heavy, but it has a lot more options.
Okay, kind of lightweight version then would probably make sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, also, so is this like are we staging the data within the service? Is that what, like, you say you get them from these disparate data sources and they're put into some sort of a staging area?
You can. So there's a concept of what's called a hub inside of this that's actually bringing these things together, and that's kind of behind, under the covers a little bit. But you define what the output is, what your target. So one use case that recently I was thinking about was we had stuff that say we had a SQL database with file stream objects in it, like binary data. Maybe somebody's looking to say, let's take that binary data out and put it in blob storage and, you know, kind of rip it, shred it, you know, kind of thing. We could do that with SSIS, but we could also do it in this and we'd take it right to blob storage. So that's kind of a neat concept.
Oh, so you would set up a job and then continuously feed it to this? Is that how it works? Like, how does it run now?
Yeah. So the pipeline is what defines that. So when you define those data tables, you can say how quickly you want them to refresh. Now, you can't do it super granular at this point. I think the fastest you can make it go is every 15 minutes. But yeah, you set that, you define that, and you can define that independently. So like your data source maybe a slower, you know, refresh than maybe the output, but that's probably backwards. It's probably more refresh on the source side than the target side. But you can define those independently. And then when you set the pipeline up, you basically give it a date range. And you can say, run this pipeline every X minutes in this side of date range. You could run it forever, or you could say, only run it during the week, or only run it during these specific hours. And then you tell it what it's called time slices. So you tell it, like, if you're going to run every 15 minutes, and it'll basically go out and build this grid. You can see when it's going to run. It has a great telemetry system and everything built into it, so you can monitor the system. Rides on top of our alerting system as well, so you can set alerts and all that kind of jazz. If something starts to go off the rails, you get alerted to what's going on, and there's a lot of diagnostics built in there.
Oh, sounds good, yeah. And I mean, is this how does it work from a pricing perspective? How do we charge people for this service?
I mean, it's in preview right now. Okay. There's pricing details up there, but it's based on these what's called activities. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing and that's what's defined in that pipeline I was talking about. So you can do a copy activity, you could do a transform activity. There's a bunch of different ones that you can do that's up there if you look at the JSON syntax documentation we have behind it. But yeah, it's basically like 30 cents a transform or something like that. It's a crazy thing, but it's.
So wait a minute, Kel. Did I just hear you say that? So I'm just trying to follow the order of events. So you were designing something with a customer. We're in preview. Did they put this into production or?
No.
Okay, I thought you and I were going to have to go back and have a little discussion about this.
Yeah, it's running right now, Evan. Financial transaction. No.
Okay.
No, it's the thing I was thinking about it, and this is not just one customer. I've heard this ask before, and I'm not even sure that this fits for that, but I've been kind of like researching into this to see if this might be a good tool for it. Because one thing you could do is you can actually replicate data with this too. So you could say, like, even in BlobSort.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You could, inside Azure, like replicate your own stuff like through there, because you're basically just doing a copy activity.
Well, that's interesting. But it'll be every 15 minutes at most, right?
Yeah, the thing is, it's not a trigger-based thing. It's more of a schedule, time-slice-based system as opposed to a trigger.
If you have something, though, where you don't mind a recovery time, mean time to recovery of, you know, X number of minutes, basically assume it's half of the 15, right, on average, that might be a kind of cheap and easy way to do it, potentially.
Yeah, if you have like a read-only replica or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Just for reporting. That is a cool idea.
Yeah, I think it's going to have a couple different uses. I mean, I think the primary use was to take all this unstructured and structured data and be able to join it together and put it in a clean format that you can then report off of and that kind of stuff. But I see it having a bunch of different uses, like I just mentioned. So I think it's a cool service.
Yeah, that is cool.
Okay. Now you said something just now which was interesting. You said it takes a lot of unstructured and structured data and combines it. And I think we also do something similar with our Hadoop HD Insight service, right? That also combines sort of different data, but that doesn't do any transformation. That's the difference, I suppose.
Yeah, and this has some native support for that Mahout, and I'm not a big data guy by any stretch of the imagination, but I know that there is one of the sources in there is something of Mahout, so maybe you know more about that, but that can read directly from something coming out of Hadoop and be able to use that as a data source as well.
Cool. Very good. Excellent. So is there any programming involved here? Like you said, you could write some of these transforms. Is that just XSL transforms, or can you actually write code?
You can write code. So there's these things called custom activities, which essentially is like a little way for you to inject code into there. It's fairly limited right now, but, you know, a majority of the work that you can do in a web browser with JSON syntax. It's a little I'll just give you my personal feedback. I mean, using it, you know, there's a GUI for some of the stuff. So when you go in and define your data sources, if you go through the portal and click on, you know, the tiles and things in there, it'll like walk you through kind of like a wizard type thing and, you know, set up your data sources and those kinds of things. But it doesn't do everything. Like it'll do the nice things like your connection strings to your databases and things like that, your blob storage, you know, your keys that you're using for that so that you don't have to do that directly in JSON. But then when you start defining pipelines and things like that, then you have to just go straight to JSON.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you templates out of the box, like when you go to define these. It's kind of neat. It's like almost like an IDE in there, this JSON editor they have that's really cool. I don't know if that's part of the Monaco stuff, but it's really nice because it formats nice. It does all the indentation for you, but then it also kind of helps you whenever you're writing. It doesn't do IntelliSense or any of that kind of stuff. But when you put the templates in there, it formats everything really nice for you while you're doing it. And it's cool. Like, once you set up one of your data sources, if you want to set up multiple, like I mentioned, blob storage, you can do this thing called clone in there. So you can basically just, like, have one defined and hit clone, and it'll create another copy of it right there on the fly. And then you can just change the name of it and change a couple of details that you want. And then you basically, what's called deploying it, but you save it up to the server. And so it's very quick to spin these kind of things up. It's nice.
So is it safe to say this is sort of like a managed SSIS service?
Yeah, I'd say it's a lightweight version. I mean, it definitely doesn't have all the features of SSIS, but from a very basic sense of being able to transform from relational to non-relational, yeah, it does that. The other neat thing that's about it that I explored a little bit was the on-premises component. So I saw that and I figured, you probably have to have a VPN set up or something like that. But no,
it uses one of those proxies, right?
Yeah. So it's got this little agent thing that you install when you go to do that. So it has a certificate involved. So basically, you go and tell it, I want to use an on-premises SQL server. I think it supports Oracle as well on-premises at that point. But anyhow, you set this up when you go through there, and it'll say, are you doing that on the machine you're on right now? Just click on here, and we'll install this thing, or this agent, or you can go download it and then install it, and then they give you a key. Basically, you put that key in there. There's a certificate, and it'll set up this connection between there. It's called a data gateway. And then once you have that data gateway set up, it becomes another data source, and then you can just start either pushing to it or pulling from it.
That's very nice, very convenient.
Yeah, I think it's going to have a lot of uses. It's pretty nice. It doesn't have all the features of some of the bigger ETL tools, but for quick and dirty moving data around, and I'd like to explore it a little bit from the replication side and see what it's capable of there, because I see some good use for that.
And the main draw that I'm seeing having this up in Azure as a service is that the process is managed, right? You don't have to have somebody babysit this thing all the time or keep an eye on it. It's something that's very predictable. It always happens every so many minutes or hours, whatever time you set. And you've got all those statistics. You've got all the diagnostics built into it to give you the feedback, the alerting, etc. So it's something that you could just set up and not have to worry about. Is that the kind of the main draw, having it as a service as opposed to doing it yourself?
Yeah, like a slimmed-down version of SSIS, PaaS version, kind of thing, where you're not managing all the other stuff with it. So it's got a great fit there.
Great. Well, thank you, Hale. That's definitely something I learned a lot today on that one.
we'll get some of the product group on and talk about this. Maybe we can get somebody from that team on at some point here and talk a little bit more detail.
Yeah, it'd be nice to know kind of what their thoughts about where they're going. I mean, like, is this – like, again, these are kind of full feature things, but is this kind of where SSIS is going conceptually, right? It wouldn't surprise me if that's out of that same team, right, out of the SQL, the what do they call themselves now, the data platform space, right? And so I wonder if that's kind of where the vision for this is. It'll just add in more features to the point where, maybe that is SSIS at that point, or that is what it is, so.
Well, they've moved Azure to the cloud. I mean, not Azure, SQL Server to the cloud. So they're going to have to move all the supporting tools, I suppose, as well, right?
Yeah, I just remember, I know there was some talk around this when I was still with the SQL Server team. And the thing I always just kind of scratch my head about is, the single slowest piece of these kind of activities is moving the data. Right? And so maybe this is one of the – this sounds like this is in some ways a solution to that, where you just kind of are always doing it, so you're not doing these big, huge chunks of data all at once, right? You're kind of doing the diff as you go through. But even if you're not, even if you are doing a bigger chunk, the service just handles it.
Right.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like eventually consistent kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, obviously it's not for every workload and the like, but, man, I mean, who hasn't written some sort of tiny app to get data from A to B, and it's in different formats, and you got to parse it or, do whatever with the, dump it to CSV and then parse it in. I mean, who hasn't written one of those? Kind of neat to just be able to just kind of wire it up now, and it just works. I actually kind of I wish I could plug that into something I own internally because I'm tired of maintaining the code.
Yeah, that's like one of the canonical examples that they show is taking a SQL Server table and, you know, with a couple lines of JSON, it can spit into blob storage that table in CSV format, which was that's pretty neat, you know.
Yeah.
And then you can obviously play with it and transform it around into different things. But and the other cool thing is you can use Shell, so they got an API on top of this thing. So a lot of the things I've been talking about you can also do programmatically from even PowerShell.
Yeah, that's cool.
You can enable, disable, create new things, all that jazz.
Yeah, so the other thing is, did I miss somewhere? Did JSON take over the world over XML? I guess XML lost.
XML was a little fat, you know, so it was, JSON was slimmer and he won.
Yeah, exactly. It was the hare and the tortoise. Yeah, I just like it. This just struck me the other day because, you know, some of the stuff in our new, in the Ibiza portal, right, the new portal is all that stuff JSON, right? The templates are JSON and everything. And I mean, there's still a lot of XML floating around. You know, you look at our network config, right? Or the VNets. I mean, that's all XML. But yeah, it really looks like JSON. I need to get better at JSON.
Even on this thing, you know, I'm doing a lot of work with the new .NET, the DNX, and that's all in JSON now. The config files, everything is all JSON there. They don't use the, you know, the application config file or the whole XML formats anymore.
So what is it? DNX,
the .NET execution environment. You know, the new version of .NET is called DNX.
Oh, okay. I had missed that. So,
this is the multi-platform .NET, right?
Runs
on Mac, the Linux and Windows. It's all JSON there.
Wow. Well, yeah, I guess I do need to learn it. All things being equal, when you said XSL transforms earlier, I just cringed. I mean, those things are, the people that can do them are amazing. I used to work with one of the escalation engineers who was like a whiz at that stuff. We would take all of our hard cases to her on that because, man, other than simple stuff, trying to write an XSD transform and stuff, oh, golly.
I used to always cheat on that one whenever I had to do an XSLT transform. I would actually fire up the BizTalk mapper. You know, BizTalk has a very nice XSLT tool built into it. It's a GUI tool. You know, you can just drag and drop things, and it spits out the XSLT for you.
Wait a minute. You mean I supported XML for 8 years, and I didn't know about this? I would have spun up an instant of version of that internally just to solve my cases. Oh, golly. I wish I'd known.
Yeah, but fortunately, I haven't had to do that in a while. So. All right, so that was an excellent show, I must say, considering we just talked on one topic. We wound up talking a whole bunch of things. Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.